narrow back alleys around Bradford's university was sealed off tonight as police made a detailed search of the area. The body was found by a patrolling officer, well hidden behind a low stone wall at the back of a large terraced house in the city's Bedsit area.
Jim Hobson's new team of policemen has now taken over the Ripper inquiry. And already they claim to have had a pile of new information from the public. But they warn women who've been going out armed with knives and sharpened steel combs that they do risk arrest for carrying offensive weapons.
I just see you as a beast with no feelings, and you're a coward. Why do you come up and stalk young girls, innocent girls as well? You come up from behind them, they don't have a chance. You're not a man, you're a beast.
Police believe it may have lain unnoticed there since Saturday. Ripper Squad detectives from both Yorkshire and Manchester were quickly called to the scene. And tonight, the Home Office pathologist who's dealt with all 11 Ripper victims, Professor David G, was carrying out an examination of the body.
Jane was a beautiful girl. You took life from her. You destroyed her family in one way or another. Her father just deteriorated. You're not a man. You're despicable. I despise you intensely.
Tonight, one hospital in Leeds is on red alert after telephone threats that one of the nurses there would be the Ripper's 14th victim.
Oh, you can hit their headlines all right, but it's nothing to be proud of, the things that you'll do. And I just don't know how you can sleep at night.
He has already killed two women in this central area of Bradford and attacked one other. I understand there are similarities in the way that this woman has died.
A deep sense of fear and resentment has built up in this Yorkshire community after 5 years of fruitless police inquiries into these brutal murders is hard to convey.
You are the lowest of the low.
Following the tape-recorded message from the man they believed to be the Ripper, in which he'd warned that he might strike again in September or October.
He was murdered in 1977.
He is the question in relation to the Yorkshire Ripper murders.
Likely is a chappy who's perfectly respectable, who goes about his normal everyday business without giving any indication that he is the man responsible.
It is anticipated that he will appear before the court in Dewsbury tomorrow.
21 months ago, Wilma McCann was savagely murdered in these streets. Since then, four other women have met a similar death, and one has been horribly injured.
Is it fair then to say that the general hunt for the so-called Yorkshire Ripper is now being wound down? But from this moment on?
Right.
All six women have been attacked in the so-called red light areas of Leeds and Bradford, the Chapeltown and Manningham districts. All but one of the victims were what the police have described as women of easy virtue. They weren't professional prostitutes.
I tell you that we are absolutely delighted with developments at this stage. Absolutely delighted.
This is the Death Cast, and this is the Yorkshire Ripper. Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten, and as always, I'd like to thank you for joining me. This week we are taking our second look into Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, possibly the most infamous of British serial killers behind Myra Hindley and Ian Brady. Before we get into it this week, as always, I have a couple of plugs and show notes. If you enjoy the Deathcast, please consider subscribing on your favorite podcast service. While subscribing, please also consider leaving a 5-star review. They really do help with the show. The more 5-star reviews a show has, the higher the podcast platforms place them in their algorithms. If you are interested in purchasing any of the 6 novels that I have released to date, you can find them either on Amazon, just search Ian Totten, or you can go to the show's official website, CorpseCreekPublishing.com. While there, please think about signing up for the mailing list. You can also click on the donate button while you're there and buy me a cup of coffee. If you would like to follow me on social media, that would be Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and MeWe. Just search for Ian Totten or The Deathcast. I am on all of those platforms. You can also find me on Twitter under Corpse Creek Publishing. More than that, though, if you just can't get enough of the sounds of my melodious voice, type me into the search window on any podcast app. I've been on a variety of podcasts as a guest at this point. Everything from the Opperman Report to wrestling shows and authors' roundtable podcast. I'm pretty much something of a whore, so you can find me all over the place. And lastly, if you're an animal lover, someone who believes in animal rights, I would ask you to go to PayPal and type in Day One Animal Shelter. Consider making a donation to them. The young woman who ran the shelter unfortunately passed away at the end of January, beginning of February. She was a very young girl. And the people who worked with her in this animal shelter are trying to keep her dream alive. Again, that's Day One Animal Shelter. There will be a link in the description of this show. So do me a solid, go to PayPal or click on the link that's in the description of this show and leave a donation. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a comfy place to sit, get something to drink, kick back, relax, put your feet up. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go to Yorkshire. When we were last in Yorkshire, the Ripper was on a tear, so to speak. The police had an overwhelming amount of clues and suspects that they were looking into, and we had just moved into 1980. On August 20th of 1980, a 47-year-old woman named Marquette Walls was murdered. From what I can find, Marquette was most likely working as a prostitute when she happened to catch the eye of the Yorkshire Ripper. As with the other victims, she was struck from behind with the hammer. Her breasts were found exposed, and then she was stabbed about the chest, throat, and genital region. This particular assault is somewhat important in that it began what some believe to have been the Ripper's spiraling, which, for those of you who are not familiar with the term, serial killers, shortly before they are caught, seem to go into a type of psychosis where they act indiscriminately, and it's thought that this is because they have gone for so long without any repercussions or being caught in any form that they feel invincible and really invisible to both law enforcement and the general public's detection. The idea that they've gotten away with it for so long feeds their ego and makes them feel powerful. So at this point, they really start to go out of control with the things that they are doing. The reason why this is important is, to the best of anyone's knowledge, the Yorkshire Ripper had been taking fairly long cooling off periods after each one of his murders, with maybe a victim or two who survived scattered in between the known murders. However, my personal opinion is that there are other victims that we are unaware of who have just never been found or identified as victims of the Yorkshire Ripper, or survivors who, for whatever reason of their own, decided not to come forward and say that, hey, I was attacked by this guy. And I'm not faulting them for that. Yeah, you have to imagine that being attacked by someone who has slain so many women and surviving that attack has to be a very traumatic, life-altering experience that they probably would not want to relive. The first of the known attacks after the murder of Marquette Walls was Abhadya Bandera, which took place in Leeds on 24th of September 1980. As with the other victims, she was assaulted before behind before the attacker was scared off. The next victim was an art student who was actually attacked on the grounds of Leeds University on October 25th, 1980. That was Maureen Lee, who went on to be something of a, you know, a famous artist in the Leeds area, particularly because she was a survivor of the Yorkshire Ripper and subsequently went on to paint pictures of him in an effort to help herself heal. The last known victim to survive the Yorkshire Ripper was a 16-year-old named Teresa Sykes, who was attacked on November 5th, 1980 in Huddersfield. Teresa had gone to a local grocery store to buy a pack of cigarettes, and to go home, she decided to take a path that ran alongside of a what's being described as a grasslands, which I imagine is, you know, an overgrown field. Unfortunately for Teresa, as she was walking down this path, the Yorkshire Ripper spotted her and began to follow her. And at some point on this path, he struck, hitting her from behind in the back of the head with the hammer. Now, Teresa had the wherewithal that as she fell, she turned around and tried to grab the hammer from her attacker, and in doing so, she got a very good look at the man's face, which she later described to police that he had black hair, black beard, and a mustache. The Ripper struck again, hitting her in the center of the forehead and leaving a half-moon-looking indentation. Teresa was screaming bloody murder by this point, and neighbors, as well as her father and boyfriend, heard her cries and all rushed to her rescue. Seeing the people coming, the assailant fled, hiding in a garden while those who were attempting to save her attended to her. This particular attack is important to note because later, once the police did have a suspect in custody, he would try and give them an alibi for this evening, and unfortunately for him, the alibi he gave did not match up with the alibi that his wife would give them. Now, these four attacks in 4 months give credence to both trains of thought. A, that the Ripper was spiraling out of control at this point, and B, that there are other victims that we're just not aware of, because it's highly unlikely that he would suddenly go from having 3 months to a year in between kills to all of the sudden he's got a mass amount of assaults in a short period of time. Some people have speculated that he did not intentionally kill the three young women who were assaulted from September to November. And again, that's an idea that I find highly unlikely. I think it's just he went, you know, with time and opportunity, and as with a few of his other assaults, he was disturbed in the act of. The last known victim was 20-year-old Jacqueline Hill, who was another student at Leeds University. On November 17th, 1980, so not even 2.5 weeks after the assault on Teresa Sykes, and her body was found on Wasteland, which I imagine is an open field near the Arndale Center. As with the other slayings, Hill's body was found with the back of the head bashed in, the shirt pulled up, and multiple stab wounds in and about the chest, throat, and pubic region. Now, a few days after this, the West Yorkshire police got a tip from a man by the name of Trevor Birdsall, who contacted them to inform them that he believed a friend of his by the name of Peter Sutcliffe was responsible for these murders. It is unknown whether the police were actively looking into Sutcliffe after this tip came in. However, what happened next can only be described as luck or an act of providence. On January 2nd, 1981, Sutcliffe was in a driveway at the Light Trades House on Melbourne Avenue in Broomhill, Sheffield, South Yorkshire, when police walked up to the van that he was driving, and they noticed he had a young woman in the vehicle with him. This was a 24-year-old prostitute by the name of Olivia Reivers. Upon looking into the vehicle, it was discovered that it had false license plates on it, at which point they asked Sutcliffe to get out of the car, and they began to question him. Sutcliffe was able to get away from the constables for a brief moment by claiming he was quote-unquote bursting with pee. Afterwards, he was taken into custody and taken to the Dewsbury Police Station in West Yorkshire. The reason for this was there was a standing order to arrest any man who was found to be in the presence of a prostitute. It's not that they really wanted to crack down on the prostitution, it was that they thought that maybe they might get lucky and this man would be the suspect they were looking for. So Sutcliffe was held overnight, and the next day he was taken to the Dewsbury Police Station in West Yorkshire. While he was being questioned at the Dewsbury Police Station about being found in the presence of a prostitute, a member of the West Yorkshire Police began looking up his name, as in addition to being informed whenever a suspect was arrested in the presence of a prostitute, it was also customary for them to research this individual's name, and lo and behold, they discovered that Peter Sutcliffe had not only been questioned by the police, but he had been questioned by them multiple times in regards to the Yorkshire Ripper murders. At this point, the officer decided to go look at the area where Sutcliffe had been arrested, and acting on a hunch, he went over to the area Sutcliffe had gone to when he began urinating, which was an area of bushes, and looking around in the bushes, this officer discovered a ball-peen hammer, rope, as well as a knife. Knowing that they more likely than not had arrested the man they were looking for, this officer went back to the Dewsbury Police Station and informed the others. Now, the timeline of what happened next is kind of scattered. Some sources state that after this happened, Sutcliffe was strip searched, and it was found that he was wearing an upside-down shirt beneath his clothing, upside down in that the arms were actually on his legs, with the area at his knees padded, and the neck opening on the shirt placed perfectly on his genital area. Other sources state that that happened after the police went and looked in the bathroom that Sutcliffe had used earlier that day, where they found a knife hidden inside the tank of the toilet. What is not disputed, however, is that after this, the police really began to question Sutcliffe, and he refused to talk. They also went to his home and retrieved his wife, Sonia, whom they brought in for questioning. Sutcliffe refused to give the police any information. However, that all changed the next day when a detective inspector by the name of Boyle began to question him. The morning dragged on with Sutcliffe not giving any information. At some point in the afternoon, however, Boyle decided to let it be known that they had found the knife, hammer, and rope on Melbourne Avenue. According to Boyle, he then stated, "I think you're in trouble, serious trouble." After which, Sutcliffe became quiet for a moment before stating, "I think you're leading up to the Yorkshire Ripper." Boyle is supposed to have said, "What about the Yorkshire Ripper?" To which Sutcliffe replied, "Well, that's me." So what you have there is a guy who's not willing to admit to anything until he is presented with facts implicating him in these murders. And you see this time and time again with both serial killers as well as those who are not serials. They deny their culpability in a thing until they are given hard fact that will wipe out any of the denial that they may have. After giving this bit of information to the police, Sutcliffe went on to confess for the next 17 hours, giving the police a meticulous blow-by-blow description of at least 11 murders. I say at least because we know there are more than 11 murders and multiple assaults. You hear the clip at the beginning of this episode in last week's where the West Yorkshire police are patting themselves on the back and saying that they feel splendid to have captured the guy, as though they put in a lot of real hardcore police work in order to track him down, when in reality it was sheer dumb luck that led Peter Sutcliffe to being arrested in the first place. This happened while Sutcliffe was being interrogated. But who is Peter Sutcliffe? Peter William Sutcliffe was the first of six children born to John and Kathleen Sutcliffe on June 2, 1946 in Bingley, Yorkshire, England. Peter's father was a large, burly man who was something of an extrovert, known to be a fairly brash, hard-drinking man that enjoyed sports, while his mother, Kathleen, was said to be a quiet, withdrawn woman who had a sweet spot in her heart for her oldest born. Sutcliffe seems to have taken more after his mother than he did his father, preferring to spend time indoors with her and pursuing his favorite passion, which was reading, At school, it was said that Sutcliffe was disliked by the other boys, as he refused to play in any of their roughhousing games, preferring instead to find an area on the playground where he could be alone and read and find other small games for himself to play. Some sources state that the bullying that Peter received in school for his withdrawn mannerisms extended to being at home, where both his father and brothers would taunt him for not being quote-unquote masculine enough. When he entered what is called secondary school, or to us Americans would be considered middle school, the bullying and taunting he received from the other boys grew in intensity, so much so that eventually Peter began weightlifting, something that his father took notice of and in fact encouraged. Of note at this period in his time, in his life, is the fact that Peter's father took great pleasure in the fact that his oldest became strong enough that he was able to beat his two younger brothers in both arm wrestling and just wrestling around in general. We will get back into the life of Peter Sutcliffe in a moment.
From Ian Totten, best-selling author of The House of Silver Doors, The Blood Gotch Trilogy, and The Throwaway Girls of Olympia, comes Maggie, a book which New York Times best-selling author Keith Elliott Greenberg has called a classic detective story, well-crafted, and a supernatural vortex. Maggie, the name was burned into Lieutenant Carl Jablonski's mind like a brand, and had been since the night of the fire. He doubted he would ever forget that night, or how she had danced in the flames of her burning home. Maggie, who was she, and why did no one in Kaya's Crossing seem interested in talking about her or her family? These were questions without answers, quandaries that drove Carl on as he explored the darkest of the town's secrets, desperate to unravel the knots that tied everything together. Maggie, Carl felt haunted by a visage, even as the local reporter, George Murphy, told him of the blood-soaked history that lay along their path, and the horrors that it held. None of it seemed real, and yet it was. The sacrifices, the screams, the pact with the nameless ones, and the hell that she had endured. Maggie, hers was a crime begging to be solved, and he and George are the only ones with enough heart to do it. The real question is, will they survive long enough to do it? Maggie, available 11/30/2021 in paperback and hardcover. Ebook pre-orders are now available at Amazon.com. Only from Corpse Creek Publishing. You have been warned.
Also, during this period of his life, Peter began participating in sports, and he did this along with the weightlifting in an effort to get the other boys to stop picking on and bullying him. Although, from everything I have read, he was fairly unathletic and did not seem to excel in any aspect of either sports or school. When he was 15 years old, Peter left school and began working at the mill where his father worked. He left this job after a few weeks to take a job working as an engineering apprentice, which he held for 9 months before leaving again to go work at another factory,
which he left in short order to go take work as a gravedigger at the Bingley Cemetery. Sutcliffe was noted by friends and family members to pretty much avoid his father while staying devoted to his mother, although his father did notice that his son was attempting to become more quote-unquote manly, with one of the things that Peter took up being building and riding motorcycles. It should be noted, though, that his father had great concern over the fact that by the time his oldest was 18 years old, he had never shown any interest in the opposite sex, nor in fact had he had a girlfriend. This changed, however, when Peter was 20, and he and his friends went to something called a Royal Standard, which I assume was a dance of some type. These were generally held throughout England in this period of time. In fact, a man whose name would become synonymous with Peter Sutcliffe's, Jimmy Savile, started his career in show business by DJing these types of dances. So Peter approached a young woman by the name of Sonia Zuma, who was the daughter of Maria and Bodhin Zuna. Both of them were immigrants from Czechoslovakia, and by all accounts, her parents looked down on her choice of a partner, although they eventually relented when they saw that A, he treated their daughter well, was very good with money, and seemed to be a hard-working man. Peter's parents, on the other hand, they looked upon their oldest with somewhat of pride because he had seemed to turn himself around, never had a girlfriend, had no social life, now he has friends, he's working, and he has a fiance. Even though Peter would lose jobs for things like being tardy, they still took what he was doing as a sign that things were going to work out with him. They were unaware, however, that Peter had another side to his life. Some point in the 1960s, he began visiting prostitutes, and it's thought that one of these visits is the culminating moment in his life when a prostitute ripped Sutcliffe off, and he decided to seek revenge on her by having a friend drive him back to where the prostitute was working out of. Leaving his friend in the car, Sutcliffe went and found a prostitute and proceeded to bludgeon her with a hammer before rushing back to the car, at which point the two men left. This was in 1969, and it should be noting that the man who was driving Peter that night, really acting as a getaway driver, was the same man who would turn him in November of 1980. In April of 1973, Peter got a job working nights for the Britannia Works of Anderton International, and this seemed to have a steadying effect on him, so much so that the families began to put pressure on Peter and Sonia to marry. This despite the fact that they had no place to live together, and that Sonia, who was in school to be a teacher, had suffered a schizophrenic episode during her second year of doing schooling. After arranging that they would live with Sonia's parents, they married on Sonia's 24th birthday, August 10th of 1974. Years later, stories would emerge of Sutcliffe playing pranks when he had worked as a gravedigger, with one individual saying he liked to play tricks with the skeletons that were inside of the graves, taking their hands and their arms and putting them in a place in order to scare the other workers, as well as stealing rings and other valuables from the corpses that he was charged with burying. One of his brother-in-laws would come out and state that the two of them would often go drinking in the early to mid-1970s in the red light districts, at which point Peter would begin to regale him with tales of his sexual exploits involving the prostitutes who worked in the area that they happened to be in that evening. This despite the fact that he went to great lengths and pains to show the world that he was a loving, devoted family man who, while quiet, was a hard-working individual. Another thing that would emerge years later was the man who had turned Peter in 1980, Trevor Birdsall, came out and stated that the two of them would spend hour upon hour cruising around the red light districts in Peter's various vehicles while Peter looked for young women whom he could pay to have sex with him. And this continued even during the period of time that the Ripper is known to be active. And in fact, Birdsall at one point stated that when Peter hit the young woman with the brick or hammer, sources vary on what he used, he later told him that he had done that and that Peter had driven him there to do it. Despite that, this man remained friends with Peter up until Sutcliffe was arrested for being the Yorkshire Ripper. After marrying Sonia, Peter took what is called a redundancy package, which I believe is the same thing as getting unemployment. It was for $400, and he used this money to get a license to drive large trucks, which in America would be a CDL license. On June 4th, 1975, he passed his test and received an HGV test class 1, at which point he bought himself a Ford Corsair. And he began driving as what in Britain is called a lorry driver, where in the rest of the world, or English-speaking world, is called a truck driver. Also during this period of time, the Sutcliffes, that would be Peter and Sonia, attempted numerous times to have a child. Unfortunately, every time they attempted to, Sonia suffered a miscarriage. And eventually, she was informed by doctors that she was unable to carry a child to term. And it is thought that this disillusionment about being a father further fed Sutcliffe's violent fantasies and led to him perpetrating the second attack in 1975, which he stepped out and hit the young woman over the head with the hammer, only to be scared off by a neighbor. Which, if you know anything about serial killers, is not that uncommon. Oftentimes, there is a catalyst that leads them to take the step from burglaries or assaults or whatever it is that they happen to be into outright murder. And it's very likely that this failure to be a father is the catalyst, as he was perfectly capable of being a father. It was his wife who was unable to carry the child, And it's known that Sutcliffe had a deep-seated hatred of women, which may really have manifest fully at this period of time in his life where it was found that his wife was unable to make him a father. Interesting fact about the period of his life when he was committing the Yorkshire Ripper murders, Peter's friend Trevor was with him during a number of nights when he was known to have either assaulted and or killed a woman, and he would actually use being with Trevor as his alibi when questioned by police. Obviously, Trevor, not suspecting anything, would say, "Certainly, I was out with him. We were going to the different bars, yada, yada, yada," instantly alleviating the police's suspicions of him. What they didn't know that was that Peter was, in fact, leaving Trevor for periods of time during which he would go out, find a victim, and murder them before coming back to continue carousing with his friend as though nothing had happened. Sutcliffe eventually found work driving trucks for a tire company, all the while continuing with his murderous rampage. Over the ensuing years, he and Sonia were able to purchase a house, and she worked to complete her teaching degree. Sutcliffe, I've read different things saying he was kind of slow-witted, when in reality he was not. He had a very good idea of what it was he was doing. In fact, he routinely bought and sold cars in an effort to make certain that the same car was not seen in the same or similar areas too many times, and did this in an effort to throw the police off of his trail. After his arrest, there were many people who said that Sutcliffe's friend and wife should be held as accomplices to his crimes, and this didn't happen. In fact, his wife, Sonia, would state that very often she would spend nights at home by herself watching TV while she believed her husband was out working. Although he would tell her things such as, "If anybody asks, I was with you," or "I was working," he always had a way to get her to give him an alibi. While his friend apparently had no idea of what he was doing beyond the incident in 1969, the police learned upon looking into Sutcliffe and questioning him that he'd developed a history of being a peeping Tom, often looking into the houses of female neighbors. But not just that, he would also go and find prostitutes and then follow them while they did their business with various customers. And it's thought that this type of behavior further denigrated the women in his eyes, as he saw them as nothing more than objects to be used and scorned. When Sutcliffe eventually went to trial, he used an insanity defense, claiming that, quote-unquote, God had told him to kill the women because they were filth. He did this by pleading not guilty to 13 charges of murder, but guilty to manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. Sutcliffe's defense attorney stated that he thought he was doing God's will, as he heard voices, which he claimed first began speaking to him when he worked as a gravedigger. These voices, it was said, told him that they were God and that he needed to kill prostitutes. It is interesting to note that leading up to his trial, four psychiatrists stated that he suffered from paranoid schizophrenia, and the prosecution was fully ready to accept this diagnosis. However, the trial judge disagreed with this decision and instead insisted that it go to the jury. This, I imagine, has more to do with the outrage and fear that the public had lived under during the Ripper's reign than it does with following the letter of the law. And I say that because Sutcliffe did end up spending years of his life at Broadmoor Mental Hospital, which is a hospital in Britain for the criminally insane. If you're a fan of Batman, think Arkham Asylum, very similar. It's a high security mental institution slash prison. So it's obvious that he did have some severe mental issues. I think this is more of a case of a judge deciding to seek retribution rather than follow the rule of the law. Sutcliffe ended up being found guilty after a 2-week trial and being sentenced to 20 consecutive life terms, or as they say in Britain, whole life tariffs. In the early part of 1981, the Home Office in Great Britain put together a report by the Inspector of Constabulary, Lawrence Byford. This has come to be known as the Byford Report. This report was not released until 2016, with large areas of it never having been released to the public. However, the report does state, "There is a curious and unexplained lull in Sutcliffe's criminal activity. It is my firm conclusion between 1969 and 1980, Sutcliffe was probably responsible for many attacks on unaccompanied women, which he has not yet admitted, not only in West Yorkshire and Manchester areas, but also in other parts of the country." This is based on Sutcliffe's arrest record. I didn't get into every single arrest he experienced during his life, but he was brought to police attention and arrested numerous times, either for soliciting prostitutes or, in at least one occasion, being found in the possession of a hammer, for which he was charged with having burglary tools. The report further states, "We feel it highly improbable that the crimes in respect of which Sutcliffe has been charged and convicted are the only ones attributed to him. This feeling is reinforced by examining the details of a number of assaults on women since 1969, which, in some ways, clearly fall into the established pattern of Sutcliffe's overall modus operandi. I hasten to add that I feel sure that the senior police officers in the area concerned are also mindful of this possibility, but in order to ensure full account is taken of all the information available, I have arranged for an effective liaison to take place." And basically what he was saying there is that the police were going to continue to investigate further to see if there were any other attacks that he may have been involved with, but as we know now, that really didn't take place. There were a few attacks that were attributed to him where women were found to have survived, but my own opinion, again, there are many more that were never attributed to him, either because the police didn't want to make it public or because the survivors did not want to go through the trauma of reliving it all again. While in prison, Sutcliffe changed his name to Coonan, using his mother's maiden name. I have to imagine this was in an effort to avoid being targeted by other prisoners who might see either assaulting or murdering him as a way to up their standing within the prison hierarchy. He was first imprisoned at the HM prison, Parkhurst. He was eventually assaulted by a career criminal by the name of James Costello, who plunged a broken coffee carafe into his face, giving wounds that required over 30 stitches to close. In March of 1984, Sutcliffe was sent to Broadmoor Hospital. This despite the protestations of his trial judge. Again, the judge was looking more to exact retribution than he was in following the laws of the country. Over the course of the next few years, Sutcliffe's wife was able to obtain a separation from him before finally being granted a divorce in July of 1994. On February 23rd, 1996, he was attacked in his room at Broadmoor by a man named Paul Wilson, who attempted to strangle him with a cable from a pair of headphones. In 1997, he was attacked by another inmate by the name of Ian Kay, who stabbed Sutcliffe in the left eye with a pen and severely damaged the vision in his right eye. All of this was going on is when the controversy surrounding Jimmy Savile and Sutcliffe came to light, because Savile had carte blanche at a number of hospitals and mental institutions throughout Great Britain, with many of them referring to him as the governor. When I say carte blanche, I mean Savile was actually placed on the directory board of Broadmoor Hospital based solely on his charitable works, raising money for the hospital and other institutions, with no real background in psychiatry or mental health. When I say he had carte blanche, I mean Savile was able to come and go from these hospitals with impunity. Many of them, he actually had his own set of keys. He was able to keep RVs at some of them. And in a few of them, he actually had his own set of rooms and an office that was solely dedicated to his use, which for Jimmy Savile meant he used him as a area to do his particular band of self-promotion. During that period of time that Savile was in Broadmoor and Sutcliffe was in Broadmoor, they got to know each other, with Savile later stating that Sutcliffe was his quote-unquote mate. Because of this and the two bodies being found within close proximity to Savile, as well as the fact that the majority of the victims were slain in Leeds, which was Savile's hometown as well as his main area of residence. After Savile's death, the rumors that he had been an accomplice of the Yorkshire Ripper really made the rounds in British media, with one of the former constables who had investigated the Ripper case stating that he felt that Savile was more likely than not part of the Yorkshire Ripper circle. My personal opinion, based on years of research on Savile, is that this is highly unlikely, as Savile moved around much too often to be involved in any sort of serial killings. Yes, he was involved in serial molestation, but the idea that he would risk everything that he held dear in his life, which is namely his financial status and public image, by putting himself in a position where an unhinged individual could potentially get him caught, is highly unlikely. And there are those who say, even if Savile had been implicated at the time, nothing would have happened because of his stature. He was an OBE and he was eventually knighted, I believe, in 1989. If he was involved in serial murders, there is nothing that he could have done, and there's nobody that he knew, not even the various prime ministers and royalty such as Prince Charles and Princess Diana, that would have saved him from going before a judge and a jury for his participation in this series of crimes. As for Sutcliffe, he continued to be assaulted while in Broadmoor. In 2005, he was granted a short supervised release so that he could go and see the area where his father's ashes had been scattered, which caused a considerable stir in the British press. In 2009, it was decided that he was fit to leave Broadmoor and go back to prison. Although, from what I have seen, he stayed in Broadmoor until 2016, when he was sent to HM Prison Franklin in Durham County, Durham. An inquiry was opened into further crimes Sutcliffe may have committed in 2017. It was thought by police that he may have gone into Denmark and Sweden under the guise of being a truck driver and murdered women there, although from what I have seen, there has been no evidence produced stating that he went to either of these countries or that any crimes could be linked to him. In fact, one of the members of the task force publicly stated that they were absolutely certain he had never been to Sweden. In November of 2020, Peter Sutcliffe, aged 74, was admitted to a hospital suffering from what was reported to be COVID-19. This after reportedly suffering a heart attack 2 weeks prior. Sutcliffe, who, if you see pictures of him, he wasn't an overly attractive man. One of his eyes was offset from the other, but he was not an unattractive man. He was fairly tall and well built. Later in life, he became extremely obese and suffered from diabetes. When Sutcliffe was admitted to the hospital in November, he reportedly refused treatment and succumbed to all of his medical conditions on November 13th, thus ending the life and career of the Yorkshire Ripper, although his legacy of brutality remains. That is it for the Deathcast this week. I hope you enjoyed my two-part series on the Yorkshire Ripper. Again, if you like this show, please consider liking and subscribing on your favorite podcast app. Please leave a 5-star review. And please look at the show notes for the link to the Day One Animal Rescue. Click on it, go there, and make a donation. The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Until next time, stay morbid.